following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening. This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs. Will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Friday. Happy Friday, everyone. The weekend is right around the corner. I'm Nicole Sandler, and the hot topic today is still sexual assault, sexual harassment, people in power. There's a new allegation out against Jeffrey Tambor, of all people, on the show Transparent, that he's harassing and worse, people who work on the show. I hate hearing these stories. With each one, I get more and more upset. And I'll tell you, the story about Al Franken still has me rattled, because I deep down don't think he's a bad guy or a serial sexual harasser. I think I don't know what to make of this story, but frankly, I'm not going to concentrate on that right now, because there's another story that's just as important, if not more so, when it comes to our economic future. And that is, as we knew it would, that Paul Ryan tax scam passed the House yesterday. All the Democrats, with the help of only 13 Republicans, voted no, but it sailed through anyway. And now it moves on to the Senate, where yesterday it went through the Senate Financial Services Committee. It passed on a party line vote, 14 to 12, and it'll go to the full Senate for debate and amendments. And yes, there was a hearing, go figure. So I guess that accounts for the order that John McCain likes, the regular order. Although pushing through a bill like this in the matter of days, let alone weeks or months, as it should be, is just wrong. But something happened yesterday in this Senate Financial Services Committee. There was a bit of a dust-up between Senator Sherrod Brown and Orrin Hatch. And let me just play it for you.
Well, of course, Senator McCaskill and Senator Casey and Senator Stabenow and Senator Nelson are voting against a $4,000 raise that this tax cut is going to bestow on them. We know it's coming. We know you'll have way more money to promote that than we will have to defend it. But that's why the Wyden Amendment is so important. And I just think it would be nice just tonight, before we go home, to just acknowledge, well, this tax cut really is not for the middle class, it's for the rich. And that whole thing about higher wages, well, it's a good selling point. But we know companies don't just give away higher wages. They just don't give away higher wages just because they have more money. Corporations are sitting on a lot of money now. They're sitting on a lot of profits now. I don't see wages going up. So just spare us the bank shot, spare us the sarcasm and the satire. And
I'm going to spare it, but I'm going to just say to you that I come from the poor people.
And here's Orrin Hatch, who doesn't talk about anything having to do with policy.
Career for people who don't have a chance. And I really resent anybody saying that I'm just doing this for the rich. Give me a break.
I think you guys
ever play that all the time, and it gets old.
Give us a break. Well,
frankly, you ought to quit it.
Mr. Chairman, the public believes it.
I'm not through.
Okay. Ooh.
I get kind of sick and tired of it. Now, true, it's a nice political play.
Well, Mr.
But
Chairman,
it's not true.
With all due respect, I get sick and tired of the richest people.
Regular
in this
order,
country,
Mr. Chairman.
Getting richer and
regular
richer.
Order.
And richer.
Order.
Regular middle. We do a tax
cut. Regular order.
Middle class.
Wait a minute. Regular
over
order.
And over and over again.
Wait just
how many
a
times do we do this before we learn this?
You go, Sherrod. Listen, Brown.
I've honored you by allowing you to spout off here. And what you said was not right. That's all I'm saying. I come from the lower middle class originally. We didn't have anything. So don't spew that stuff on me. I get a little tired of that crap.
Aw.
And let me just say something. If we worked together, we could pull this country out of every...
Oh, shut up. All right, I'm going to shut him up because he doesn't say anything about the policy at all. He just goes off on, he's gaslighting us again. He's saying that he's upset that the Democrats keep talking about how these tax cuts will just benefit the wealthy. They will. Sherrod Brown, at the beginning of that exchange, referenced an amendment offered by Senator Ron Wyden. And that amendment would undo the tax cuts on corporations if wages don't grow. You see, the Senate bill would cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20% permanently. But the individual tax cuts, those sunset in 2025 and 2027. And so those are only temporary. And so that's what Sherrod Brown was talking about, saying, well, you know, take up Senator Wyden's amendment. And that's what ticked off Orrin Hatch, who, by the way, is retiring. He's not going to continue. So that's what's going on there. I want to play for you a clip. It was Robert Reich was on All In with Chris Hayes last night, and he was talking about. He was explaining that Sherrod Brown was right and Orrin Hatch was simply gaslighting us.
Over the next 30 years, the really rich billionaire and semi-billionaire baby boomers are going to be transferring about $30 trillion to their children. I mean, you're going to have the biggest intergenerational transfer of wealth in history. Huh. And if they can eliminate the estate tax and if they can actually wangle things so that there's no capital gains tax, think of that we are creating a dynastic class in America as fast as we possibly can.
Yep.
It shouldn't be called the estate tax. Certainly is not the death tax. We should call it the dynastic tax.
Yeah, it's a really good point that we're enshrining a dynastic class. On the loser side of the ledger, and I thought you would have something to say about this because you're an academic. You've worked in academia. You teach at Berkeley. Grad students. I mean, so here you have billionaire donors. The Adelsons are going to stand to gain about $15 billion. Meanwhile, grad students who are not living high on the hog, if you know any grad students, if there are any grad students out there watching, are looking at a 400% tax increase because essentially the full value of their tuition stipend are going to be counted as income. They're now going to be paying taxes. If they're making $10,000 a year paying taxes on $70,000, they are hosed.
Well, they're hosed. Graduate students are hosed. The people who are really sicker and older and depending on the Affordable Care Act, they are getting hosed because it's going to be $300 billion taken from them and given to corporations and the rich in terms of tax cuts. I mean, what this Republican bill, and if you look at both bills, what you see is just an extraordinary amount of money that is being redistributed upward from people who don't have very much or have almost nothing to people who have everything, who are people who have never had in the history of America more. And corporations who are flush with cash, American corporations are right now pulling in half of the profits of all corporations in the entire world, even though we are one-fifth the size of the world economy. And what are these corporations doing it? Well, what they do with all this money is they buy back their shares of stock in order to raise the price of the share of stock. And by raising the price of the share of stock, they're not helping all Americans because the top 1% owns about 40% of the value of the shares of stock, and the top 10% owns 80% of the entire stock market. So once again, Chris, however you look at this, this is a redistribution upward from the average working person and the poor to people who have never had it so good.
So there's Robert Reich talking with Chris Hayes about why, you know, Sherrod Brown was right in what he was saying in that clip. And Orrin Hatch had no concrete argument to fight back. He had to just go, I come from the poor people. I'll give it a rest. That's going on. We'll check in with Talk Media News Service in just a few minutes after this look at what's news.
I read the news today. It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
With a mostly party-line vote of 227 to 205, Republicans rammed a $1.5 trillion overhaul of business and personal income taxes through the House Thursday, moving a step closer toward the tax code's biggest rewrite in three decades and the first major legislative triumph for the Trump administration.
This is about giving hardworking taxpayers bigger paychecks, more take-home pay. This is about giving those families who are struggling peace of mind. It's about getting this economy to grow faster so we get bigger wages, more jobs, and we put America in the driver's seat in the global economy once again.
Now attention turns to the Senate, where its bill moved out of the Senate Finance Committee Thursday night on a party line 14 to 12 vote. But the fight in the Senate is expected to be tougher. Congress's nonpartisan Joint Commission on Taxation estimated that the Senate plan would mean higher taxes beginning in 2021 for families earning under $30,000 annually. By 2027, families making less than $75,000 would face tax hikes, while those making more would enjoy cuts. Robert Reich explains who this tax scam really benefits.
This entire escapade, this entire tax cut is payback for the Republican donor class. This is what it's all about. I mean, Republicans are not really looking at the polls right now. They are very aware of the fact that the donor class, I'm talking about, you know, the Mercers and the Ricketts and the Koch brothers and all of the people that have invested so much in the GOP, what they want is they look at this as any other kind of investment. They want a return on that investment. And the return on the investment was going to be a huge tax cut. The stock market has been going up in anticipation of a corporate tax cut. It has nothing to do with the real economy. It has nothing to do with what's happening to average people. It's just a big payback for the major donors.
Senator Al Franken faces a likely ethics investigation after Leanne Tweeden, a Los Angeles radio personality, accused him Thursday of forcibly kissing and groping her during a 2006 USO tour in Afghanistan. He's the first member of Congress caught up in the recent wave of allegations of sexual abuse and inappropriate behavior. In a press conference, Tweeden explained what prompted her to come forward now.
And really, I'm doing it now because it's different. There's strength in numbers. Congresswoman Jackie Speier has come out and she's talking about it now. And when she said she had that experience when she was in her 20s as a congressional aide and came out and said her chief of staff stopped her in an office and grabbed her face and kissed her and stuck his tongue in her mouth. And we had her on our air, and she said that to us while we were interviewing her on McIntyre in the Morning, the show that I'm the news anchor on. And I said, I looked at Doug, and I went, I kind of mouthed, I'm like, that was Al Franken to me. And I said, I think that was my catalyst to sort of go, you know, if I'm going to tell my story, now is the time. 2017 is not 2006. You know, it's just a different time, and maybe I can be somebody's Jackie Speier, and they can tell their story in real time and not wait.
Franken issued a lengthy apology in which he asked for an ethics investigation of himself, something the Senate majority and minority leaders also called for. The president weighed in on Franken via a couple of tweets, calling him Al Frankenstein, but he still hasn't commented on the Roy Moore allegations. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was asked about that during her first press briefing since they returned from Asia.
Does the president believe Roy Moore's accusers, or does he think Roy Moore should drop out of this race?
Look, the president believes that these allegations are very troubling and should be taken seriously, and he thinks that the people of Alabama should make the decision on who their next senator should be.
So that's a no, he thinks Roy Moore should stay in?
Look, the president said in his statement earlier this week, that if the allegations are true, then that Roy Moore should step aside. He still firmly believes that.
Of course, the president still insists that all 16 or more women who have accused him of sexual harassment are lying.
You say that the president finds these allegations against Mr. Moore, Judge Moore, to be very troubling, extremely troubling, etc. As we all know, the president faced a number of similar allegations or somewhat similar allegations during the course of the campaign, and he vigorously denied them. But I wonder what you would assert to be the difference between the two situations such that on the face of things, we should find one set of allegations very troubling, and on the other, we shouldn't pay attention to them at all, or we should totally disbelieve them?
Well, I think the president has certainly a lot more insight into what he personally did or didn't do, and he spoke out about that directly during the campaign, and I don't have anything further to add beyond that.
Part of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline was shut down Thursday after 210,000 gallons of oil leaked in South Dakota. The leak comes before Nebraska officials are scheduled to vote Monday morning on whether to approve a 275-mile-long extension of the project through that state. State approval is needed after the Trump administration revived the project, even though it had been rejected by the Obama administration. A bipartisan group of senators have joined forces on legislation to strengthen the FBI database of prohibited gun buyers after the Air Force failed to report the criminal history of the gunman who killed more than 24 people at a Texas church. The bill would ensure that federal agencies and states accurately report relevant criminal information to the FBI. The bill also seeks to improve accountability by publicly reporting which agencies and states fail to provide the required records. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution. My work is 100% listener-funded, and I can't do it without you. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. All right, for a little bit more of what's going on in the news, we turn to our friends at the Talk Media News Service. They're at TalkMediaNews.com. On the line today is Doug Christian. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Nicole. How you doing?
Doing okay. So what's happening out there?
Well, you know, as you might expect, of course, when there's one allegation, there are more that follow because people become less afraid that there are going to be terrible repercussions.
Yeah.
They've been holding these secrets in. And so now there's a second woman who's come out against Al Franken and Melanie Morgan.
Oh, Melanie, but she's not alleging sexual harassment. Melanie Morgan, I'm sorry. Melanie Morgan is a right-wing hack, and she's not alleging sexual harassment. She's saying that after she was on his show once, he called her and gave her a hard time because she was a bad guest or something like that.
I am so glad that you corrected on that. I just was, I saw that, and I thought, wow.
Yeah, In fact, a group of eight former staffers for Al Franken put out a statement, and they said, many of us spent years working for Senator Franken in Minnesota and Washington. In our time working for the senator, he treated us with the utmost respect. He valued our work and our opinions and was a champion for women, both in the legislation he supported and in promoting women to leadership roles in our offices. That was part of the statement. It was signed by eight women who were staffers of his. I'm not, defending Al Franken here, but I just do want to be fair. And what I'm saying is, I want to see if anybody else comes forward because, if it's a one-off, maybe I do question the motives of someone who is a right-wing operative, someone who has been a guest on Sean Hannity's show many, many times, who's, she's a Fox kind of person.
Absolutely. That's a big difference.
Right.
Big
difference. So when you said somebody else has come forward, I my heart dropped a little bit because I really don't think this is – I don't think he is that.
And
the Melanie Morgan thing
is
different.
Totally agree. I think one of the things that I'm really very grateful for liberals, for Democrats having done is not protecting their own tribe when they see problems. When Kirsten Gillibrand came out and said, no, Bill Clinton should have resigned in the wake of the, I felt this is good because that's one thing we cannot do is be hypocritical. That's one of the biggest problems that's facing the Republican Party right now is their inability to look squarely at their own problems.
That's true. And, you got Donald Trump, who's so quick to criticize Al Franken, hasn't said a word about Roy Moore. And his response whenever, they're asked about all of the women who have come forward to say that he's assaulted or harassed them is to say they're all liars. Oh, he was going to sue them all. Of course, there hasn't been a single lawsuit.
No. And of course, the reason why he is threatening to sue them is to shut them up. But the reason that he hasn't sued them is because then they have the right to defend themselves and seek finding to depose him.
That's right.
And that would just open more cans of a bigger can of worms for him, because then he'd have to directly address the accusations rather than to just kind of to smear these people on the podium.
Yes, he would. Yes, he would.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a terrible tragedy that he was elected president. But I'm hopeful that this inspires people next time to get out and vote, because over 50% of people who were eligible to vote didn't.
Right.
And that is a huge problem.
Yes, it is. Well, I'm sure many of them didn't vote because they didn't like either of the candidates, but still, that's good enough. Even if you have to go out to vote against one of them, which is frankly what I did, I had a feeling Trump was going to be this bad. Actually, nothing prepared me for how really bad he is. I really didn't think he could be this heinous, and he is.
No, he truly is. He's, you know, it was Graydon Carter, who's retiring as editor of the of Vanity Fair,
mm-hmm.
Who actually coined the phrase, because he made his his living on needling Donald Trump early on when he was the editor of Spy, coined the phrase. That I called him a small-fingered vulgarian.
Really?
And yes. And what he said was that Donald Trump is the most vulgar human being he has ever met. And, I mean, he should know. I mean, he's a person who has met many, many high-powered people in his
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, just from a distance, that's how I see him. I don't claim to be in his orb, even though I'm here in D.C.
All right.
Yeah. So anyway, but you know, it's very interesting. This or sad too about the new tax bill, which is also trying to take benefits away. From education benefits away from people, and of course, what's so sad about this is that the GI Bill, as it was originally written, was written primarily by Republican congressmen.
Hmm.
These were people who actually cared about the. It was originally called in 1944 the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, and it was actually written to benefit. Veterans, not just veterans who fought, but all veterans during that time to get a college education. So it's particularly tragic to see the Republican Party take aim at benefits for people who benefit from education subsidies. And tax those benefits.
Right. Which, and especially graduate students. I mean, it's going to do away with the deduction for student loan interest. It's going to tax tuition credits. It's really, I mean, horrible for college students and grad students, many of whom are going to have to drop out because they're going to get taxed on whatever stipends they get, any kind of credit they got towards tuition, they'll be taxed on. So it could be somebody earning $10,000 a year who has to pay taxes as if they were making $70,000 a year, which is impossible.
That's correct. And I mean, and for instance, when you take the GI Bill, for instance, that bill was credited for the amazing economic growth that the United States enjoyed post-war, because you had an educated populace.
Right.
And of course, what's happening now, and one of the reasons why there's such pressure on the H-1B program is because there are not enough scientists for tech companies, Microsoft, Google, to hire domestically to get the job done. So they need educated people, and they get them from overseas. This is one reason why Bill Gates actually started a research center in Canada, was because it's easier to get people into Canada to do the research than it is into the United States.
The problem is, Doug, there are plenty of people who are fully qualified. The companies here, though, just don't want to pay the salaries that it would take to hire those people. So they say they can't find qualified employees, and they say they need to bring them in under H-1B visas. I know for a fact there's a regular listener of this program who has run afoul of that. He's got all these degrees. He's a scientist. He can't get work, and yet for jobs that he's qualified for, companies are bringing in workers under H-1B visas and paying them less.
There are some companies that are really taking that are really abusing that. And they're kind of there are certain players that are actually known for abusing that system in that way. And the big companies, the big tech companies, and pharmaceuticals. Hire these people as contractors rather than bringing them in as full-time employees.
Or rather than paying fully qualified American citizens because they'd have to pay them too much money. You know, these corporations are making record profits. The stock market is at an all-time high, and they're not increasing wages. This is the fallacy that the Republicans are giving us, saying, you know, they'll take these corporate tax cuts and they'll increase wages. That's just nonsense.
That's exactly right. And another thing is that the whole argument about lowering taxes, that tax rate on these corporations, is that somehow the corporations are going to magically pay workers more money.
Right.
There is, and of course, then the stock price goes up because they say, well, of course, the companies are going to make more money. They're either going to be spending more money to hire people, or they're going to be pocketing more money. Given what the stock market is doing, where it is rising tremendously, stock pickers believe that these companies are going to be pocketing the money, and that the shareholders are going to benefit, not the workers.
And that's exactly what's going to happen. In fact, yesterday, I don't know if you heard the dust up between Sherrod Brown and Orrin Hatch in the Senate Finance Committee when they were moving the Senate version of the tax bill. And Sherrod Brown was talking about the Ron Wyden amendment. Well, that amendment would undo the tax cuts on corporations if wages don't grow. And of course, that's what got Orrin Hatch so hot under the collar, because he knows that wages won't grow, and he had to go off on a tangent of how he comes from the poor people, and he's been working my whole stinking career for people who don't have a chance. Went off on some tangent of just nonsense because he didn't want to address, you know, the elephant in the room.
That's right, and he is such a long way from his claimed childhood at this point that it's a sophistic argument to bring up. And he knows better.
Yeah.
He definitely knows better.
Yep.
I mean, the thing is, there are a few Republicans, and I don't know if there are enough yet, to defeat this bill.
Well, there are a few who haven't said. The only one who said he's against it is Ron Johnson, who I don't trust. I think he'll come around. But it's the usual suspects. It's John McCain. It's Susan Collins. It's Lisa Murkowski.
Right.
Then it's Bob Corker and Jeff Flake also, who are possibilities. Bob Corker, because if it adds to the deficit. But that's why they're doing this, you know, the individual cuts will expire in 2021 and 2027, so that that allows them to do this under reconciliation, because it doesn't reduce the deficit more than the 10-year plan. I get all jumbly up at this point. You know, they're saying, well, they'll never let them expire. Well, you know, I don't believe you.
No. And also, the thing is that it's particularly ironic that the Republicans, who used to be deficit hawks, now all of a sudden are justifying deficit as long as they are doing tax cuts.
Yep.
And which is it's so sad, because when President Obama tried to rescue the world economy by injecting money into the system, there were many deficit hawks that said, oh, no, we cannot increase the deficit, even if it meant going into risking a Great Depression.
But right. But if it's to give their donors major tax cuts, they can do it. It's called Republican hypocrisy, and it's their middle name. Yes. Anyway, Doug Christian from the Talk Media News Service at talkmedianews.com. We are out of time. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'll talk to you later. Take care.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Coming up, Derek Rowe is going to join us. Derek's been on the program before, but there's news out of his district, and I thought it was a good excuse to have him back on. So we'll check in with Derek Rowe from Texas 21st Congressional District, where he is running as the Blue America PAC-endorsed progressive Democrat in the race. Stick around. I'm Nicole Sandler. We'll be right back.
Trump now owns a massive new tower he might not want to put his name on. I'll tell you about it today on Hightower's Radio Lowdown. If you've ever been to one of the cities graced with a Trump hotel, casino, resort, etc., you know that the Donald splashes his name in giant, gaudy letters across every structure he owns, preferably in gold. Now, he's taken ownership of a massive new structure, and he might not want his name on this one. It's Trump's towering redo of America's tax law, and it's truly golden. For the super rich, that is. Revealing in hard numbers whom his presidency really serves. Not just the 1%, but the 1/10 of 1%ers who are multimillionaires like, guess who? Him. First and foremost, the Trump tax plan slashes the payments that giant corporations make to support our nation. He claims that this will let corporate elites raise the wages of workers and create jobs, winking at the fact that, of course, the elites will pocket every dime of his tax giveaways. And shh, don't mention a little secret gotcha. A third of his corporate benefits go to foreign owners of American corporations. Meanwhile, Trump's luxurious new tax structure eliminates many benefits for middle-class families, such as tax deductions for medical expenses, college tuition, and interest paid on student loans. He wants modest-income families to pay more so he can eliminate current taxes on his own uber-rich family, including killing the alternative income tax paid by the rich and the estate tax, which applies only to the immense fortunes of a handful of America's richest families. This is Jim Hightower saying, did I mention that the gilded tax structure proposed by this self-described business genius would hang an additional $1.5 trillion debt around our children's necks? No surprise, for Trump's grandiose luxury projects were often built with other people's money, advancing himself before he slipped away, leaving others to grapple with the bankruptcy.
If you'd like more of Jim Hightower's real populism, check out the Hightower Lowdown. Jim's monthly newsletter gives you the real lowdown on which corporations, by name, are doing what to the middle class, our environment, and our democracy. Each month, the Hightower Lowdown brings you facts you didn't know, along with actions you can take to fight back. It also comes with a sense of humor. Hightower believes we can fight the gods and still have fun. Plus, get this, it's cheap. Only $15 brings you 12 issues a year. For real populism, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
You're listening to The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back. As I mentioned before the break, Derek Rowe has been on with us before. He's a Blue America endorsed progressive Democrat running for Congress from Texas 21st District, the seat currently held by Lamar Smith, who announced last week that he's not seeking re-election. So we thought it was a good idea, a good time to invite Derek Rowe back to the show to talk about his campaign. Hey, Derek.
Hey, how are you, Nicole?
I'm doing well. And you?
I'm great. You may hear a little background noise today because I'm also watching my 3-year-old while we're having our conversation.
Well,
today,
that's more important.
Enjoy yourself.
Okay. So the news that Lamar Smith was dropping out, how did that come to you, and what was your reaction?
Well, our reaction, I'll do that part first. I mean, our reaction was that it just demonstrated to us that what we'd been saying for months was true, that this was a winnable race, that this district is sliding our way rapidly. And it was clear that Lamar Smith looked at that same set of numbers and thought he better go play with his grandkids instead of face the music in this district for the next 6 months. The way that we found out about it, we just saw it break on Twitter and it kind of came out of the blue. We had heard rumors for a year, but, you know, when you've got an incumbent that's been in for 16 terms, those rumors are always persistent. So we just had been ignoring them and moving forward. But now this means it's anybody's race. It means that whoever runs in his place on the Republican side has to agree to debates because they're not an incumbent and they need a name ID. So it fundamentally changes the dynamic, and it shows that we're on our road to winning this district back for progressives.
So what does the field look like now? Have any Republicans jumped in yet?
There have been. There's been a state representative named Jason Isaac who has joined the fray, and he has part of a current district that he represents in the state house that overlaps a little bit with this district, but he doesn't live in the district. The same goes for a perennial opponent of Lloyd Doggett's, who is a former mayor of San Marcos. Her name is Susan Narvaez, and she also doesn't live in the district, but she had some previous jurisdiction over part of the district. There's been a couple other folks whose names have been mentioned, but those are the two big ones. And I think if those are our opponents, we're going to be in pretty good shape because our ideology is in pretty stark contrast to their conservatism. And I don't think that's a fit for this election cycle.
Right. Well, you are an unabashed progressive. And, you know, looking at what happened in Virginia last week and even 2 weeks ago and even in Oklahoma last week, where we had a very progressive state Senate candidate win, unseat an incumbent. It seems as if, and it's a message that the Democratic Party is not getting yet, there's a progressive wave that's happening. People are looking for candidates like you.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we started off this race looking at the numbers and saying, look, this is a moment where progressive messages are the ones, those values can pull this country back together after 4 years of Donald Trump. And it's not just that it's the right political moment for it, it's the right moment for those policies. We absolutely have to have things like Medicare for all, climate change action, college for all, you know, fighting income inequality. Those kinds of things are the kinds of things that are going to be necessary to fix the damage that Donald Trump is doing to this country. And when you get out there and you talk to people about that and they understand the impact of those policies that you're proposing, it shows them that you're fighting for them. And they also want to know that you're not going to be somebody that gets cute in front of a microphone. I think one of the appeals of people that are winning and becoming more popular in these cycles, like Bernie Sanders, for example, and even to some extent Donald Trump, is that people have no doubt that they are at least going to talk a good game about fighting for you. And if they hold a position, they are going to be out there defending it instead of trying to feel out a particular audience. People want to know you have some kind of principles. Donald Trump lied about all of his, of course, in the race. But what I think was appealing about him to people in some ways was just the fact that he was brash and unapologetic about the messages he was putting out there. And even if people disagree with some of those things, they at least thought that guy's going to go in there and take a hammer to the system. Now, he took a hammer to everything. That was a terrible mistake on those folks' part. But if you look at somebody like Bernie Sanders, even if folks disagree with Bernie Sanders, they know they can trust that he's telling them what he thinks and that he's telling them what he's going to do and they can take it to the bank. And I think the time has come and gone for this kind of bland centrism that the D.C. Democrats keep trying to push on us.
I couldn't agree more. I talk with Howie Klein every week about the problems within the Democratic Party. The DCCC, have they reached out to you at all, or are they ignoring you because you're a progressive?
You know, we've had some conversations on and off with the DCCC. I would say it's clear that they are always kind of looking for a centrist in any race because that's just their reflexive reaction to these things. They haven't endorsed anybody in our race, and I don't have any indication that they're going to.
Good.
We do have open communication with them, but I would say that, you know, whether we get the DCCC's backing or not in a primary, it's kind of irrelevant to what's going on the ground here. We've had a groundswell of support all across this district, you know, even in places, I don't know if your viewers are that familiar with this district, but one of the redder communities in this district is Kerrville. It's in the hill country. It's not part of the major population centers. We had 22 people show up for a block walk last time we went out there, and that's huge for that size of community. And, you know, we can replicate that all across the district where there's excitement, where there's pockets of activism. Those are the progressives.
Talk about the district, because, it, again, as with most districts, especially in red states, states with that had Republican governors in 2010, the gerrymandering is crazy. Now, part of your district is Austin, Texas. If it was all Austin, this would be a no-brainer. You'd walk right into the Capitol. But Austin is split up, huh?
Right. So Austin, as its reward for being the progressive bastion in Texas under Republicans, has been split into several congressional districts so that it doesn't have a hometown congressperson. But the good news about what's happening in our district is that the demographics and the population makeup are shifting so quickly that the assumptions that were true when they drew these lines no longer hold. So the geographic area that it covers is basically downtown Austin, south between I-35 and a street called Mopac here. And it basically goes along the west side of I-35 between Austin and San Antonio and sweeps across the hill country to places like Fredericksburg and Kerrville and Bernie. So we have most of the population clustered up against the interstate, but we also cover a very large geographic area that kind of determines what people think of when they think of this area. It's the rolling hill country, that really beautiful karst landscape with, you know, limestone and live oak trees everywhere. It's gorgeous out there. But the problem is that Democrats have walked away from those areas traditionally as looking at them as sources of votes. And so they haven't really been as in touch out there or had the infrastructure in the hill country to mount challenges that could consistently win against Republicans. They've just let themselves be pushed into Austin and San Antonio and have left the rest alone. We're reversing that. We're running a 10-county strategy. We have volunteer leads in every county. We have people organizing their own events. We have block walks and phone banks happening everywhere in the district. And what we're seeing is that people are responding to that. That has led to a level of support that we've seen that not other candidates have been able to pull together in the last 5 years in this area.
Wow. Well, that's encouraging. Derek Rowe is with us. Now, Derek and I met years ago when he headed up the Rethink Afghanistan division of Brave New Films. But you've done much more than that. Tell us a bit about your background.
Sure. I mean, I've been a congressional staffer. I've been a I've been working on Capitol Hill at one point in my career for 5.5 years for Congressman Stenholm, Smith, and Pelosi for a while. I've also been a nonprofit professional. I've worked as the communications director for the Center for Public Policy Priorities, which is a state-level think tank that advocates for working people. I've also worked most recently as the communications director for the Safe Alliance, which runs the domestic violence and children's shelter here in town. And I've also been a small business owner. I've started, operated, and sold a place called Mothership Books and Games, which is a retail mom-and-pop store. It's not a business that you go into to get rich. It's just when you want to create something tangible and have a business that's involved in the things you love. That's the kind of business that we started. And so that experience has given me a lot of insight into how hard it is to compete in the rigged economy, and then how hard it is to get leaders in Congress who have the integrity of their ideals when it comes to fighting for progressive values. And that's what I'm trying to take to this race, this experience of why it's important that small businesses need there to be a $15 an hour minimum wage so that there's enough juice in the consumer economy to support small businesses. It's also why I'm for things like Medicare for All, because you need to take that burden of providing health insurance off of small employers so they can compete against these big box companies. I mean, if you have those kinds of experiences, progressive policies are kind of a no-brainer.
Right. You know, you mentioned Medicare for All, which is obviously the progressive dream, hopefully someday a reality. We're right now in the shortened enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, but the Republican Senate tax bill would repeal the individual mandate, threatening coverage for 13 million Americans. So in the interim, what do we do? How do we fix our health care system? I mean, I'm looking at my insurance premium doubling. And I buy it off the healthcare exchange. It's just because I'm getting older, I'm one of the groups that they can go after. So that my policy has doubled in price.
Well, I mean, the problem is that as long as Republicans are in office, they're going to be continuing to try to fight to take away our healthcare. And we're going to have to fight them in the streets like we've been doing. I mean, that's why I went to jail in protest of their last attempt to repeal the ACA. But, we're going to have to beat them at the polls. because there's not going to be a fix for healthcare until they're not in charge of the system anymore. Right. Every time they get a chance, every bill that's remotely germane, they're going to try to repeal some part of the ACA. So I think what we have to do is defend the ACA vigorously on the phones, in the streets, through letters and op-eds and things like that. But we also have to be really clear that the only way out of this, the real fix is Medicare for all. I mean, we're going to have to pass it and put a timer on it of 5 years or less to get it implemented and force those agencies as vigorous members of Congress to comply with those laws that we're going to pass. Because otherwise, private companies and the allies of the Trump movement are going to continue to concern troll this thing into the ditch, and we can't allow them to do that.
The House passed its version of that tax scam bill yesterday, and now the Senate is
out of control,
working on its version. So what are your thoughts? I mean, they tell us they're experts at gaslighting. They're telling us this is middle class tax cuts. But then you look at the data that's come out, and we find that people who earn $30,000 a year or less are going to see their taxes go up as soon as 2021. This is really going to hurt low income and middle income people.
Well, it just amazes me that these Republicans are so out of touch that they think the key problems in our economy are that college is too cheap, that health care is too easy to get, and that there's too much money going to the people at the bottom. I mean, that to me is a completely out of touch and ludicrous way of analyzing the economy. But they just passed a tax giveaway that'll jack up the cost of higher ed, give big tax giveaways for things like private jets and offshoring, and then push 15 million people off their health insurance. Mm. There's no way you can interpret that as anything on behalf of the middle class. It shows that the only real uniting philosophy behind the Republicans right now is that they're looting. They are trying to scrape every bit of money they can out of public structures until somebody stops them. And that's the only thing holding the party together. That's the only thing they can agree on, is that they've got to pass these tax giveaways right now while they've got control and while Trump is clearly an executive that'll sign anything they send to him. And to me, this idea that they're doing something for middle-class folks is as laughable as the idea that President Trump is any more fit than any of the other, you know, predator politicians that are out there being excoriated in the media.
Yeah, speaking of that, I guess we should go there. We've had lots of disturbing news about sexual harassment and assault these days, the latest being allegations about Al Franken. Some are calling for his resignation. Others are satisfied with calls for a congressional ethics investigation. What do you think?
Well, let me back up and say that Congress as an institution is terribly backwards when it comes to sexual harassment and sexual assault. I mean, you could be in a process for a year as a staffer or another member of Congress making accusations about sexual harassment or trying to get justice for yourself if you've been assaulted or harassed. And at the end of that process, if you decide to press it forward all the way, the government provides a lawyer to the accused and not to you.
Right.
And then if they come to a settlement with you, the government pays it out.
Yes.
Which means that the person is not actually ever affected. And that, to me, if I get elected to Congress, is something I'm going to take on immediately.
Right.
That's horrible, and we've got to change that. When it comes to Mr. Franken, honestly, I feel like he should resign.
Do you?
And the reason I say that isn't that there's any kind of moral equivalency between him and any of the other people who are in the news cycle right now, like Roy Moore or anybody like that. It's that, you know, we are finally in this great Me Too moment where people can come forward and talk about the things that have happened to them and kind of reclaim power in a space that's been taken from them. And as a candidate, I don't want to be spending the next 6 years defending indefensible behavior. And I think that, you know, it's great that the person he was accused of wronging has forgiven him and said that they wouldn't mind if he stayed in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be consistent with our messaging here and maintain our moral authority. And every time that we go to talk about that issue, if he doesn't take that step, that photograph of him at least mimicking groping the woman while she's asleep is going to be tweeted out, and we're going to have to deal with it every time we're on the stump.
Yeah.
And I hope that he'll make a decision that will have the party in mind and not his personal political future in mind.
What a mess, though. What a mess, huh?
It is a mess. It is a mess. And, you know, the great way to avoid all this is not to behave like that.
Of course.
I mean, we need to understand that America is in a place, finally, where men can't just treat women as objects of entertainment or objects of conquest, and we have to stick to that and understand that even if people that we agree with politically take those actions and have things pop out of their skeleton in the background, we got to maintain some clear vision here
right.
and help do the things that will push us into a space where those kinds of things aren't accepted anymore.
Yeah, I agree. My only problem with the idea that Franken should resign, this is an allegation from one woman. He does say that he remembers the rehearsal part, you know, the kiss part that she talked about differently than she does. That's the part that he hasn't admitted to. You know, it seems like the Democrats are always the one when there's any suggestion of impropriety, the Democrat goes. Look at Elliot Spitzer. Look at Anthony Weiner. Look at Rod Blagojevich. I mean, we can go on and on and on. And you look at the Republicans. Right. Donald Trump is president. Roy Moore, you know, denies that he's done anything wrong, even with a preponderance of evidence that he has. David Vitter stayed in the Senate even after an ethics exam. And so I worry that Democrats are going to get rid of some people who might be really good. Look, if another woman comes forward, then my opinion will change. I think if it shows that there's a track record of this kind of stuff. But one mistake I don't think should, I don't know. This is just killing me. The whole thing.
Right. And this is the problem one of the things I think is problematic about the situation is that we end up getting tangled up. You know what I mean? Like we have somebody making an accusation. And one of the things that I'm very proud of in our party, and you're right, there is a difference between how Republicans and Democrats handle these things. But the difference between them is one that I'm proud of.
Right.
And it's one that shows that we take it seriously. And I think the thing to keep in mind about Mr. Franken's situation specifically is that this is a Democratic senator under a Democratic governor mm-hmm. who could appoint a Democrat in his place.
That's true.
So it's not like we're in a position to lose a vote, but we are in a position to lose a lot of steam and moral authority here on an issue that we ought to just grab a hold of and push as hard as possible and make it not possible to continue in public life if you've got these things hiding in your closet. I mean, I agree with you. There's only one accusation at this point, but I mean, I don't like having to get into a calculation as a party of how many we think is acceptable.
Right.
I think one is enough.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. You did bring up the fact that the House has paid out about $17 million over the past 20 years or so to settle harassment claims. It's not when we say that the government paid it out, it's actually taxpayers. We've paid for that.
Right. It's out of the Treasury. Yeah, it's out of our tax dollars. And, you know, this is another thing I think we can have some great moral authority on, you know. Representative Jackie Speier gave this great testimony saying that she knows of at least two serial assaulters or harassers that are currently serving in the House that are one is a Republican and one is a Democrat.
Right.
And I can't think of anything that ought to motivate us more as people that want to see that institution function and who seek justice as to say, let's name those folks and expel them.
Exactly.
Because Congress has the authority under Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution to expel members for disorderly conduct with a 2/3 vote.
Well,
we should do that.
Exactly.
We should clean house.
If it's common knowledge that there's two members of the House who are guilty of this kind of behavior, I'm frankly offended that anybody is protecting them. Number one, I'm offended that others who we've paid out on their behalf are protected. But I do understand Jackie Speier's it's not her argument, it's her explanation that those are settlements that are contracts and you can't go back on the contract. There's non-disclosure agreements in place. So maybe we can't proactively go back and expose those people, although I sure would like to see some investigative reporters get on that. But if there are two people, if there are two people currently serving in Congress, it's common knowledge and there are no such protections in place for them. What the hell are we waiting for?
I know. And the thing is, there are bodies in Congress that can investigate these kinds of things that are specifically there to investigate breaches of ethics. And it's not an HR process. It's an ethical process.
Mm-hmm.
And we should do that. We should also have hearings about how much of these millions of dollars in payments have been paid out multiple times for a member. We need to know if we have serial, if we've elected serial predators to the House of Representatives. And if we haven't, done that, we need to know that too. But if they're there, we need to get rid of them. And
most
Congress
definitely
should take those votes and expel those members.
Most definitely. Debbie Dingell today said that somebody years ago had molested her, basically, and she won't name names. I think it's time that they start naming names. I mean, we're talking about public servants here,
right?
People who work for us.
Well, and we should make them feel safe to do so as well.
Yeah.
And I think, and this goes back to our earlier point, the way we make it safe for them to do so is that we make it clear that if someone has done something like this, they don't get to hold power anymore. And by not being able to hold power anymore, they can't be hurt. They can't be hurting the people who are naming them as harassers.
I agree. I agree on that one. Derek Crowe, during your time at Brave New Films, you argued strongly for us to get out of Afghanistan. So here we are years later. Yep. Trump is sending more troops. We're still in Iraq, and he's threatening war with North Korea, too. How screwed are we when it comes to foreign affairs?
No, we're so screwed. I mean, look, this country has a terrible bipartisan consensus on Afghanistan that we just don't care.
Right.
And that is the only explanation for the fact that we are there well over a decade now, almost two decades now, in a war that no one can tell you the strategic justification for keeping it in place. You know, when we were Brave New, we made a very strong argument and helped flip public opinion to the point where Americans agreed that it wasn't making us safer and isn't worth the cost. Osama bin Laden is dead. There's no strategic rationale for us staying there. And we're just dumping millions of dollars per day into an endeavor that has no achievable benefit for the American people. And if you're going to be told that you can't have something like College for All, you definitely don't need to be spending money on wars that aren't making us safer and that aren't worth the cost. And they weren't worth the cost in the first place. And I think, you know, this is something we've been talking to colleagues and advisors about recently on our campaign, that, you know, there are a lot of folks out there that purport to have a progressive foreign policy. But what does that mean? And I think what it has to mean is that we reorient ourselves away from a politics on the international stage that's oriented towards where oil reserves are and start taking leadership in the green economy. And if we want to counter Russia's moves, what better way than to be going into countries where they have leverage over people because they have to rely on Russian natural gas or oil reserves, and helping them become energy independent through green technology. Now, that kind of foreign policy could put our enemies on the ropes and also happen to benefit the rest of humanity.
Right.
Instead of us fighting over an energy resource that's unevenly distributed and happens to be in the hands of despots, we don't need that on our foreign policy books. We got to get off of it.
Yeah, well, and the first step would be to elect a Democratic House, certainly, and perhaps
yes,
even Senate in 2018, and then to get rid of Trump in 2020, if not sooner.
Right. Right, absolutely.
Yeah. One last question for you, Derek Crowe. One of the
sure
things that the big Democratic victories in Virginia showed is that people won by focusing on local issues in their district. What do your future constituents care most and worry most about?
It's interesting. I mean, most people will tell you that you shouldn't run on things like climate change, but half the doors we knock on, people say that that's their top issue.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that their previous representative has embarrassed them so badly on the national stage by being such a crank about it. Lamar Smith, for folks that don't know, is the climate change denier in chief. He sits on as the chairman of the House Science Committee.
Aye.
And spends his time trolling climate change scientists instead of trying to get to the bottom of what we can do to fix it. And I think there's been a backlash in his district. I mean, nationally, anxiety about climate change is at an all-time high, and 70% and up of his own constituents want you to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant. So I think he's just missed the boat on where his constituents were heading. And that's we see that at the doors. The other thing is healthcare. I knocked on the doors at a housing project in a small town called Johnson City, which is named after LBJ, by the way, because this is his home area.
Hmm.
And it was just a group of seniors that lived there. They were living in this project because, you know, they're on a fixed income. Almost every single one of them said that cuts to Medicaid and Medicare were their top priority to stop, and that they were terrified of what these cuts were going to mean for them. And so I think those two issues are the ones that are most important. But rural issues are also really important here, and things like broadband access are really important. So preserving, you know, the rural development funds in USDA, including the funds that provide broadband and clean water access,
mm-hmm,
are really important in the Hill Country. But it's climate change and healthcare otherwise.
Gotcha. There's a, speaking of broadband access, on a related note, there's a net neutrality fight coming up pretty soon as well. Another important issue.
Right. Right. And Lamar Smith has been terrible on this issue for his constituents. This idea that, you know, we are going to have a metered internet, essentially, and let these companies pick and choose winners. And those winners, by the way, will just always happen to be these major telecom monopolies and oligopolies. That is the end of the open internet as we know it. And I don't know about your viewers, but I'm really tired of seeing these Comcast ads in my social media feed that say they swear they're not gonna, you know, weight the internet like right. We're worried about. They promise. They just don't want to be told they have to be fair. And I think anytime you listen to companies with that kind of doublespeak, you know that the fix is going to be in the moment that those regulations are gone. In our area, if there are rural small businesses, they require an open internet to be able to compete against big box competitors. Yeah. Otherwise, they can just be pushed off the table.
Exactly.
And that's just one other way that when they don't have broadband access and it's not a free and open internet, they're going to have a hard time competing against these big box
competitors. Derek Crow, we're just up against the clock. It's Derek Crow, C-R-O-W-E, electcrow.com is the website, and you can find him on Twitter at electcrow. Thank you so much, Derek. We'll talk again
soon,
Nicole. I'm sure.
Thanks, Nicole. Great to talk to you.
You too. Take care.